February 8th, 2025, Bayagiri Monastery. And we're a little over a month into our winter retreat period. So we've been doing readings, listening to teachings. And the theme is fairly loosely defined this year, just teachings of the Krupa Ajahns, or traditional teachings, traditional ways of practice. So there's a few themes that have been coming up in the teachings. And I'll just, by way of review, recollect a few of these themes and see where it takes us. Some of these themes come from the suttas, and some of them from the readings, such as the readings. I just did a couple readings from Lungpa Liam. So, and then there's also readings of Lungpa Cha. So there's a number of threads, a number of themes that goes through all of these teachings. And the teachings of our own Ajahns, they really do dovetail well with the suttas. And so I think they, having sutta readings plus the readings from these Ajahns, they really reinforce each other. One of the themes that comes up, I think, with Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Liam is the theme of just perseverance, just sticking with it, just not giving up. Like there was one of the readings where Lungpa Cha says, "You know, I'm no different than you. The only difference is I don't give up." Yeah. So that sense of perseverance or determination over the long term. And there's also metta, goodwill, forgiveness, and having a non-judgmental attitude towards each other. That's also important. There's a cat screaming in the background. That's it is what it is. It's giving its own Dhamma talk. One of the pieces of advice Lungpa Sumedho gave one time, somebody asked him a long time ago, what would be some of your advice for living in community? So here at Bayagiri, we have a big community, and the winter retreat crew are all different individuals, and the monastic community, we're all different individuals with different personalities. And this person asked Ajahn Sumedho, "What's your advice for living in community?" And he quickly replied, "Don't define each other." And I think that's what a lot of these teachings are pointing to, is the we get stuck on definitions, stuck on the conditioned world, and stuck on the externals, you know, stuck on the way things look from the outside. And there's many examples in the suttas where, and actually disciples of Ajahn Mun and that generation of Krupa Ajahns, where a monk ended up being an arhant and nobody knew, just because he was totally normal, totally ordinary. There's a not very well-known disciple of Ajahn Mun, and I can't recall his name right now because he's so not well-known. But he was just living in a monastery, and he wasn't actually the abbot or the senior monk. He was just living as one of the monks in the monastery and just doing the chores, doing the sweeping, helping look after the monastery. It turned out he was an arhant. And he was just doing the duties in the monastery. He wasn't giving teachings. He wasn't doing anything out of the ordinary. He was just doing the alms round and interacting very normally with the others. And only after being cross-questioned by another senior monk who kind of noticed him, did he find out, oh yes, this one actually is free of suffering. Completely free of suffering. That's hard to know, because the human being isn't a set of ideals. A human being is a human being. The Buddha wasn't like this Buddha image, this beautiful Buddha image, which reminds us of the Buddha. the Buddha was a living, breathing human being. And all of the teachers of the past who reached the end of suffering, they were all living, breathing human beings. And sometimes when we hear about these teachings, we hear about these really high ideals. And some of us may have read the biography of Ajahn Mun, for example, but it's so hard to encapsulate somebody's entire life just into a book. So we read a book, and that's a whole set of ideals, and they push themselves really hard in this way or that way. And we might see that with a critical attitude. We might think, okay, we'll have to really get down to it. There is some truth to that, but also we need to take our time. We need to make haste slowly. And the way we're doing anything, the way we do anything is going to condition where we're going. So when we read about the biography of Ajahn Mun, or even Stillness Flowing, the biography of Ajahn Chah, trying to encompass someone's entire life into a book, into a reading, it doesn't really give an accurate picture. It can't give an accurate picture because it is just a description. Even the best possible book can't give a truly accurate picture. We have, to get a bit of a better picture, we have, say, people like Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Pasano who actually lived with Ajahn Chah, and they can talk about what it felt like to be around him, what it was like to be around him, and some of those personal stories that fleshes out the picture of who Ajahn Chah was a little bit better. And Ajahn Mun's biography was written by Ajahn Mahabua, so then Ajahn Mahabua's personality comes into that, and he was that kind of dauntless warrior type, and in his own personality, in his own practice. Then other disciples of Ajahn Mun would say, when asked what you remember most about Ajahn Mun, one other disciple said, oh, his sense of humor. But you don't necessarily get that from the biography. So when you think about just all of these greats, all of these great teachers we read about and hear about, really it's the daily life practice that caused them to become who they became, who they were. They became great through just getting up in the morning, doing the morning meditation, doing the morning chanting, going on the alms round, and doing their practice, doing the sweeping in the monastery, doing the chores in the monastery, putting their heart into the activities, doing a good job, reflecting on the meal before, during, and after eating the meal, and doing things like walking meditation. And so just engaging in these daily monastic life duties that we do. This is what we call the Kichawata. In Thai, they say Kawat. In Pali, it's the Kichawata, just the daily duties, the daily etiquette that we follow. And that builds up our practice. So we can become true people, true human beings. And this is what Sila Samadhi Panya, this is the, that could be a hackneyed term. I don't want to say this is the real practice, but it is. It is the daily life practice, the ordinary practice. Because a human being isn't an ideal. A human being is a human being, has a body and a mind. And these things aren't ideal. These things aren't ideal. This is dukkha. So this is what we have to see, that the body and mind is not ideal. It's not an ideal condition. There is no such thing as an ideal condition. Or we might think we want ideal conditions to live in. We want to create some ideal conditions. But it's never going to be perfect. It just has to be, get to a point where it's good enough. The body is healthy enough. We're comfortable enough with our lodging, our dwelling place. The food is good enough. The weather is good enough. It's quiet enough. And that's good enough to develop the heart to practice. And actually, sometimes if there's adverse conditions, that's good, because then that pushes us, that causes us to see where we're still stuck, what still causes us to suffer. The way out of suffering isn't avoiding conditions that make us suffer. The way out of suffering is seeing those conditions that make us suffer and seeing why do they make us suffer so much. So we're just doing our ordinary daily life practice, the Kichawata in the monastery, looking after things, getting on with things day by day. That's the practice. And it's a great blessing to be able to do this. And it's just ordinary. It's in the moment. We're not achieving great things. Or it's, you could say it's kind of a paradox, because we are achieving great things if we can be totally ordinary in the moment. That's unusual. That's rare in the world. And we can be true human beings. There's a story that is Master Xuanhua, the late abbot of the City of 10,000 Buddhas, told. And I've told it before, but I haven't told it in a while. And it's a nice story about how to not have a judgmental and critical attitude towards people, and also that we shouldn't be judging by appearances. And this story is about, in old times in China, there was a national master, and he was quite overweight. He was quite an overweight monk. And there was also another monk, the Vinaya master, the discipline master. And he was also living at that same time. And the Vinaya master, he lived on the top of a mountain and practiced all these austere practices. So he did the sitter's practice. He would never lie down, for example. And this Vinaya master was extremely virtuous and had a very, very strong practice. And he would, he had so much virtue and blessings that he actually didn't need to go down the mountain to either make his own food or seek food on alms round. There was a certain deva, a celestial being, which would come each day and visit him and take like a human form and offer him food, and offer him very, very good celestial food. So at a certain point, word spread to the national master that the Vinaya master was getting offered deva food every day. And the national master thought to himself, I've tried every type of food in the world and I love eating, but I've never tried deva food before. I've never tried celestial food. I want to try celestial food. That sounds really great. And so he decides to make his way up the mountain to see the Vinaya master, and actually for the express purpose of sampling this type of food that he gets offered each day. And so the national master, he's quite overweight, and it's hard for him to walk up this mountain. So he's huffing and puffing up this mountain, and he finally gets to the top. And he's really happy because he's made it before the mealtime, so he's going to get to try this food. And he says, I want to try this food that I hear you get offered each day by this deva. And the Vinaya master says, okay, well, it should arrive in a few minutes. And nothing happens, and the deva doesn't come. So the Vinaya master is kind of perplexed, and well, maybe it'll come the next day. So the national master decides to stay up on top of the mountain with the Vinaya master. And then through the night, the Vinaya master is sitting, and then the national master is lying down snoring. And he's kind of snoring very loud and drooling as well, and seemingly not very beautiful the way he's sleeping. And so the Vinaya master starts to develop critical thoughts of the national master. He's, oh, this national master, he's pretty big for a monk, and he he's snoring really loud, and it's really disturbing. And the kind of the Vinaya master, he kind of adjusts his seat a bit, and he's kind of starting to get a bit restless. And then in the morning, the national master wakes up, and he's kind of, the Vinaya master is still kind of thinking critical thoughts of him. And then they're waiting again for the meal to show up, and again, it doesn't show up. So the national master says, "You're the Vinaya master. You're not supposed to lie. What are you talking about with this day? You said this deva was going to show up with food." He said, I swear it comes every day. This is the first time it hasn't shown up. I don't know what's going on." And then the national master says, "Yeah, and furthermore, you were having all those critical thoughts of me last night, but what you didn't know was when you shifted around, you killed a bug, and that bug came to me to kind of, I had to litigate on your behalf. That spirit of that bug came to me and wanted to punish you." And I said, "Oh, wow, okay. Wow, this guy actually, don't judge by appearances." So then the national master, he's kind of upset with the Vinaya master, and he goes back down the mountain. The Vinaya master is kind of perplexed. Why didn't this deva show up? So then the next day, the deva shows up at the normal mealtime. He says, "Hey, why didn't you show up?" And the deva says, "I wanted to, but I had the food ready to offer, but there was this blinding golden light where you normally are, and all I could do was circle around at a distance. I couldn't actually get close. It was too bright." I said, "Oh, okay. That's why he's the national master and I'm just the Vinaya master. So don't judge by appearance." So that's a good cautionary tale. And we can apply that to ourselves in community life. You know, people who may be a certain way, but we can't actually see their mind, and we don't really know what's going on inside for them. So people may develop different mannerisms and habits over time, and we may develop a judgmental, critical attitude toward them. Either maybe somebody moves very slow, for example, and we think, "Oh, they're kind of spacey and slow," and that attitude, those type of thoughts lead to negativity. It's actually unwholesome. And it's not what we want to be cultivating. Or we might think, "Oh, this person's moving way too fast. They're all over the place, and it's pretty stressful, and they're just kind of zooming around all over the place." And then that's also going to lead to that judgmental, critical attitude, which is unwholesome, unskillful. So it is difficult to come out of that, because that's a mental habit. That's an unwholesome mental habit that we can get stuck in. So there's that. There's one is we don't know what's going on internally for people. And two, people can actually change, and people do transform themselves. People have insights over time, and people do train themselves. This can happen, especially in the monastery. So people can actually get better and improve. It's not that we need to cubbyhole people. They're this way, probably always going to be that way, and so on. So in kind of questioning that judgmental, critical attitude that we have in our mind, we can actually buoy the heart up, and it can become more wholesome. And during the meditation is coming up a little bit, I was thinking of just my own habits that I've been able to change through being in the monastery. And before coming to the monastery, so say as a layman, as a young man, then I think it'd be safe to say I was in a ghost realm. I wasn't in the human realm. So it's a smoking way too much marijuana and drinking a lot, and was a confused mess. And I was quite young at the time. But then when I read the Buddha's teachings, and there was some insight that happened, there was a real shift. And at a certain point, it happened very soon after I decided I wanted to ordain, then I couldn't go near those things anymore. Even if they were around, and it was a very quick, sudden shift, but there was a definite shift, a definite transformation that took place, and the habits were gone. They weren't there anymore. So, and then eventually I was able to make my way to the monastery and come out of the ghost realm and actually be a human being. And I'm very grateful for that, because that's already something really, really good. Now, being a ghost is not fun. Being a ghost is dukkha, is maha dukkha. So just that opportunity, so not to speak of, you know, liberation, end of suffering, enlightenment, but just to be a human being is just to be able to change those unwholesome habits and be rid of them, and then curb the mind in a more wholesome direction. So that only comes from insight. That can't come just from an act of will. If it was just an act of will, you just fall back into the habits. There has to be some insight for there to be a real change. There has to be an insight into the suffering of those habits, and then there can be a real change. And there has to be a determination to move in another direction. Only then can there be a real change. And I really, truly had this feeling that I couldn't go back to where I had been before. The mind, the heart was absolutely repelled from where I had been before. It's not that I was happy. I was still in a very intermediate state when those changes took place. So this is still before I went to the monastery or even knew about Abhayagiri. But even though I was in that intermediate state, looking back on it, I could say the mind was actually becoming more wholesome, but it was a painful process. So, you know, people who would have seen me or known me back then, and that's the only memories they have of me, they would judge me in that way probably now if they saw, oh, he's probably still a confused mess. But there, with insight, those transformations can take place. So yes, I'm the same person I was before, but the heart, the mind is in a different realm. It's not in a ghost realm. It's more a human realm. It's the human realm where we're able to, and it's also not animal realm, because I'm keeping precepts. I'm actually practicing to train my mind. The mind might still have some animal tendencies, but I'm not following those or giving into those. Rather, I'm mindful of them, contemplating them. So this is also another example of just how we can better ourselves. We don't have to be stuck in the same old place that we always have been. So coming back to that sense of cultivating an ordinary mind, might also have that feeling that we want to get high off of meditation, or we might hear about states of bliss and ecstasy that we can get from meditation. And that's perhaps wonderful temporarily if we can make that happen. If we can get a state of bliss or ecstasy from a meditation. But in the end, that's suffering too. It can be great suffering. That can be maha dukkha as well. Say if we attain a state of really intense bliss in our meditation, one is then when it's over, the craving can increase. All we want to do is get back to that, and the rest of our life falls apart. Or the bliss itself is actually, we can see that it's not peaceful. It is suffering. Now, bliss is suffering. Actually, that's an insight. That's an insight that Lompo Khao had. He's one of the senior disciples of Tenajin Mun. He said it when his practice reached a very advanced stage, he saw bliss as suffering. He saw happiness was a shaky, agitated state. he saw that as suffering as well. In the beginning, we contemplate happiness as suffering because we know happiness will change. It's viparinama dukkha. It's the dukkha of change. It's the suffering of change. But then at a more advanced stage, we see that happiness itself is actually suffering in the moment that it's occurring because it's not peaceful. So both happiness and suffering are not peace. So then the Buddha termed that peace was a type of happiness as well, but it's a type of happiness which is higher and more sublime than happiness as we normally know it. So not to be discouraged if our meditation is just ordinary. That's not a bad thing. In fact, it may actually be quite a good thing because it's sustainable. It's sustainable well-being. Bliss isn't sustainable. Ecstasy isn't sustainable. Being high isn't sustainable. But a sense of ease and peace and well-being is very sustainable. It's not as exciting. It's not the ups and downs. It's not drama. But it is sustainable, and then it can trend upwards. That sense of peace, the happiness of the peace, can trend upwards. And the peace of letting go. So that's another one of the threads coming up in the teachings, that, say, a bhikkhu hears nothing is worth clinging to. He personally attains nibbana. So when we contemplate nothing is worth clinging to, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. There's something inside of ourselves which we'll think, well, there's this or that which is still worth clinging to. But if we look closely and we look with mindfulness and wisdom and we see that truly nothing's worth clinging to, the mind won't be able to hold on. We can't let go. We talk about letting go a lot, but we can't let go through an act of will. We can't let go just by telling ourselves to let go. It's really only through insight, that insight that nothing is worth clinging to, that the mind won't be able to hold on no matter what. It won't be able to not let go. It will have to let go at that point. When the mind sees that there's truly nothing worth clinging to, then it has to let go. It can't possibly stay in the fire. It can't possibly keep holding on. But that's just something that in the teachings it will occur. It's said to occur through insight. So just 1 month into winter retreat, I think it's good to have some encouragement that, well, if things, however things are going, and we can just take that for contemplation, if it's just ordinary, that's good. If there's some sort of happiness or bliss occurring, that's good, but be careful. Be careful of the clinging to that. There's nothing truly worth clinging to. If it's suffering and misery, that's good. Reflect on that. Contemplate that. It will change. It's all going to change. If it's ordinary, it's going to change. If it's peaceful, it's going to change. If it's suffering and misery, it's going to change. We can actually think about the last month, and there's probably been a lot of changes already. We started out with the 3 weeks of group practice, the full-day schedule. And now it's more open, and we're starting out these solitary retreats. Some of the community members are on solitary retreat currently. Then it changes and shifts. The feeling changes. The energy changes over time. So we can reflect on these changes. And sometimes we may think, well, we're on cruise control. We're cruising. Everything's really nice, and then some sort of curveball hits us, and then we're back in dukkha again, back in Dukkhaville. So these things are always changing, and it's important to see that. When we practice, we need to have goodwill, we have to have compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. These are the four Brahma Viharas, and that's also something that can help us to be very kind and forgiving to each other as we live here in community. And we can call into question that judgmental, critical mind that pulls us down. It's a basis for resentment. There's all sorts of things that we could be focusing on which can cause the mind to become unwholesome and full of resentment. Things like, this person did that to me, this person said that to me, this person did something that to someone I like, this person hurt someone I like, this person is doing harm, that person's doing harm. All of those types of thoughts can make the mind become more unwholesome, have resentment. So finding ways, any way, you know, in the face of, even in the face of all odds, finding any way to make the mind wholesome, it's really, really going to be for our benefit. For the mind to have ease and well-being, it has to be in a wholesome state. When the mind becomes unwholesome, that's suffering here and now. So we start to see that's what the cause of suffering is. And so many places in the suttas, how do we gauge our practice? How do we see if we're making progress? It's a decrease of the unwholesome and an increase of the wholesome. The wholesome will feel good here and now. When we do experience happiness in meditation, sometimes great happiness in the meditation, or a sense of being very settled, that's because some wholesome dhammas are appearing. These wholesome dhammas of goodwill, of mindfulness, these are appearing. Because the mind isn't going into resentment. The mind isn't going into those hindrances. They're temporarily in abeyance. And so we start to see what are some of the causes of suffering, what are some of the causes of happiness. These states don't just come out of nowhere. They don't just happen to us, but they arise from causes and conditions. So we start to see the process. It's very subtle, but we start to see the process, how it arises. This is also kamma, the law of kamma, that these things, they don't just come out of nowhere. With kamma as well, we start to see that everything is relational, that the way we relate to each other, the things we say to each other, the things we do for each other, acts of generosity or kind words, those really come back to us. Whether we like it or not, whether we want it to or not, it's just natural. It's a natural law. If we're unkind, we use unkind words, harsh speech, or we act on anger towards somebody, that comes back to us. It's just natural. If we make it a habit to be kind and generous as much as possible, even all the time, that can't not come back to us. That has to come back to us. That's just the way it works. We don't know why it works that way, but it does. It just works that way. It's just a natural truth, natural law. It's not a Buddhist law. The Buddha taught about it, revealed it. Whether the Buddha teaches it or not, it's just there are these natural orders. There's this natural order of things. And we don't want anybody to be Buddhist. We don't want to convert anybody to our religion. All we want is just people to stop suffering. We can use the Buddha's teachings to see that all the suffering is just self-created. And there is a way out. There is a path to get out of it. But it's going to take some insight. It's going to take some strong determination, perseverance, not giving up. And those are ideal qualities that we can be cultivating. And we're still going to make mistakes. We're not going to be able to be fully in line with these qualities, perfect in every way. Because the mind and the heart is just, this is a human mind and heart. They just, we make mistakes, we fail, we slip up, we lose the plot. That's to be expected. But how do we react when that happens? That's what ends up defining us as practitioners. So when teaching, we teach out of the ideal ways to teach are to teach out of goodwill, to teach without wanting anything in return, to teach what is pertinent, and to try to teach without praising ourselves and denigrating others. And so having attempted to teach in those four ways, I would like to conclude the talk for this evening. So I wish everybody well. Keep going. Don't give up. We're 1 month in. So sadhu for all of your efforts and anumodana. And I'll leave it there for this evening.